ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Growing up in Melbourne, Reuben Kaye loved watching old movie comedians like the Marx Brothers and Buster Keaton. And he was always dressing up and dancing around, sometimes in dresses made long ago by his grandmother, Elfrieda. But always in the background was the weight of Reuben's family history. Reuben's parents both came from Jewish European families who were forced to flee their homes because of the Second World War. And there were other, more secretive stories involving a return to communist East Germany and a heartbreaking decision made by Elfrieda as a young woman. Reuben has made his name as a cabaret performer, an art form known for its big emotion, black humour, political satire, and gorgeous songs. And his family stories often make an appearance when he's performing on stage. Reuben is the new artistic director of the Adelaide Cabaret Festival, and his one-man show is in Melbourne later this month and again early next year at the Sydney Opera House. Hi, Reuben.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You were born Reuben Crum, so why did you choose Kaye as your stage name?
I guess at the age I was at, I didn't think that Crum was a very stagey name.
We should say it's K-R-U-M, not the same as C-R-U-M-B, but still, no, the sound is maybe not what you're after.
In German, it's Krumm, and ironically, it's German for bent or crooked, which feels
good
apt.
Good work.
Yeah, you know. And I think if I had more imagination or more appreciation for individuality at the time, I would have kept it. But I think when I had a stage name, I wanted it to sound fabulous. And I was such a fan of Danny Kaye growing up.
Now, I just need to be clear. You were born in the mid-1980s. Why was Danny Kaye a big part of your childhood? That seems of another era.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff I was exposed to must seem almost archaic, but I think it's because my parents just had great taste. We grew up in a house, this European, not religiously Jewish, but like culturally Jewish house. And that meant it was Jackie Mason. It meant it was Danny Kaye. It meant it was the Marx Brothers, lots of Leonard Bernstein. But Danny Kaye just had this childish, clownish showmanship that when I was choosing a stage name, I thought, oh, there it is. That's the embodiment of it.
So when your mum and dad weren't watching great old movies with you, what did they do for work?
So my mum is a scriptwriter, filmmaker, and my dad was a painter and sculptor.
And so who helped out looking after you and your brother when they were busy when you were little?
Well, that would have fallen to Dad as a stay-at-home artist while mum was out there earning the bread. But Dad really, I think, in many ways, was just very happy being another child with us, being a kid with us. And so a lot of it fell to his mum, Rosa, who was this Russian matriarch.
What kind of figure was Grandma Rosa to you as a kid?
To me, a huge, ebullient, warm, fabulous woman who dressed in colourful muumuus and all of her jewellery on at once, all plastic. She should never have been near an open flame. And she would play music on her radiogram, as she called it, and bang pots and pans. And there was nothing in her fridge but chalk wedges and yoga and sweets. It was a real spoiler of a grandmother, right? Which is every mother's worst nightmare.
And did she encourage you to perform?
Oh, she encouraged everyone to perform, and she encouraged everyone to be her audience. She was I don't want to say like a stage mum, because I don't think she had very little English and didn't have a concept of where everything was going, but everything was a show, very much so.
What do you know about her background?
She grew up in Stalinist Russia, so poor that she had to wait until her sister came home from morning school so she could put on her shoes and walk to afternoon school. One time in school, the teacher was trying to teach her French, and Rosa shouted, "Why do I need this? I am never going to be in France. Look at where we live." And fast forward 20 20, 30 years later when she was fleeing post-war Poland and they wound up in Paris and she was a washerwoman and doing alterations, like, oh, I should have listened.
All that force of personality that allowed her to survive so much, what did that mean for the kind of mother-in-law she was to your mum?
There is a wonderful photo of my mum and my grandmother, and in it, Rosa is looking at the camera with this beatific smile, you know, chocolate would melt in her mouth. And next to her is my mum, and the expression I would use is harrowing. She's staring at this camera with this pleading expression. I think my grandmother was very attached to her son and was not in the mood for any woman to come and take that away. So for both my mum and my wonderful stepmum, I think the relationship with my grandmother was very, very rocky.
And so did that leave your dad caught in the middle somehow between those two women?
And my dad hated conflict, couldn't bear to raise a voice. He was very loving, caring, and good in a crisis, but functionally useless between two opposing forces. Bless him.
Your mum was born in the UK to Jewish German parents. How did they meet?
My grandparents came to Australia as World War II refugees. My grandfather came on a ship called the Genera ship that brought over on this months-long journey something like 1,200 refugees as well as Nazi collaborators, all on the ship for months at a time. And my grandfather was interned at Tatura, the internment camp, and then was released, and my grandmother and him met in Australia.
This is Heinrich and Elfrieda. Why didn't they stay in Australia?
Oh, they're staunch communists. You know, my grandparents are the only people who defected to East Berlin. What a wild concept. They went back via England, and my mum was born in England. My mum grew up singing the Internationale.
They left democratic freedom in Australia and England and voluntarily returned to Berlin in East Germany. What do you know about the kind of marriage they had, your mum's parents?
I think my grandfather was a very hard man, a very brutal but charismatic man. He became quite a powerful plenipotentiary or diplomat for the East German government, where his job was to assist developing nations in trading with East Germany, which was under a trade embargo. So I think he probably had a great deal of shady dealings with a lot of these countries and probably running some arms into Angola. And Elfrieda was a dressmaker. When she had my uncle Helmut, my mum's younger brother, my grandmother decided that it was time to get out.
To leave the marriage.
To leave the marriage, but I think also to leave East Berlin, because I think there was no way to leave the marriage without getting out of East Berlin.
And what did that lead her to choose to do, Reuben?
So we have evidence that my grandmother, Elfrieda, researched what it would take to take both children, my mum and Helmut, one child or neither, and she had to weigh up her options and decide what she was going to do. And in the end, she took my mum and she left.
What happened to her younger child, her son?
I think Helmut suffered the price of being raised by Heinrich. When my grandmother Elfrieda left and left him with a son, he put Helmut in an orphanage and shacked up with his secretary, who had two kids of her own. In my mind, that's sort of like a man who effectively replaces a family with a family. And he would visit Helmut every year in the orphanage on his birthday.
So your grandma and your mum, as still a little girl, made their way to Melbourne. Where did they live?
They live in Collins Street in an atelier above, I think, where Prada is now. And my grandmother makes dresses and makes these gorgeous gowns, and we still have some of her dresses.
What do they look like?
We used to have dress-up parties at home and fashion runway walks. There's home movies of it, and the first time I saw it, me and my brother were dressing up and going down our runway, which was the front path in the garden. And then Mum walked out in this stunning sort of metallic khaki silver dress, very cinched waist, huge voluminous skirt, long sleeves, sort of a shallow boat neck neckline, and it was one of my grandmother's dresses.
So she was obviously this incredibly talented seamstress and making a new life for herself in Australia with her daughter. But what a terrible loss of her son. Do you know if she was ever in contact with him, or if that was just the end of that relationship as far as you know?
That was the end of the relationship. My grandmother, from what my mum has told me, was pretty scarred by her experiences of the war. I would imagine that if it was today, she would be diagnosed with bipolar or large manic episodes my mum's told me about, and deep, deep depressions, multiple attempts at taking her own life, eventually one which was successful when my mum was very young, in her teens.
Did your mum know all of this about her mother's past as she was growing up, or is it something that she found out after your grandma died?
My mum didn't know she had a brother until she was making a documentary called Between the Lines about Raoul Wallenberg, Swedish aristocrat diplomat who bought passports for Hungarian Jews in the Holocaust. And she went to Berlin and she met her dad for the first time, right? And as far as I know, her dad just turned to her on the street and went, "Oh, by the way, here's your brother," and was faced with this guy, tiny, malnourished, thin man with a mustache, who she had never known. He barely spoke English. She barely spoke German.
Did you ever meet him, Ruben?
He came to Melbourne once. My mum describes him as this angry, sad man, understandably. He's had an extraordinary but hard life. And when he played with me, she said it was the first time she saw him smile. I think because my mum has a history in documentary filmmaking, she's always had the mind to this inquisitive mind that's very attached to stories and narratives. And because of that, she's become a brilliant historian of our family. It's also meant that she's very courageous in facing the brutal parts of our family with this keen, not detached, honest eye. You know, my mum is a very honest person. We would never say passed away in our family, they died. You know, I think it's a slightly German way of looking at things as well, but also a maker, you know, a filmmaker's eye as well, a writer's eye. So my mum has faced all of this with that brutal honesty, I think, and I think in many ways the best thing, the most courageous thing my mum's ever done is be the end to the cycles of abuse and trauma that have gone on.
Your parents ended up divorcing. What do you remember about that time? How did life change for you?
How it changed things for me was, I think my mum had a chance to not have to be the disciplinarian for once. And my dad had to take on that role, which he was ill-suited to. And because of that shift, my relationship with my dad really deteriorated, I think, which is a real shame. I will say I never really remember them having a conflict. And to their credit, my parents all remained friends and really amicable, and all four of my parents, my biological parents and my bonus parents, would all hang out and have a bottle of wine and go to dinner. You know, I think my parents had a saying which was, "We might have fucked up the marriage, but we're not fucking up the parenting." I'm like, that's genius.
That should be emblazoned in Latin on all family courts, really,
yeah,
shouldn't it?
Very much so.
And what about school for you? What was that like?
Oh, school has never really been a happy or safe place for me.
Even as a little kid?
Yeah, I think so. Because as a kid, I went in there as if it was my home life. I didn't have any reason to think that the world would be any different. And so when I went in there and I was, you know, doing the dance from the gym at, from West Side Story, or doing Groucho Marx routines that my parents would do. The school, all the kids were just like, well, who is this freak? So I think by the time I was 5, 6, 7, I was already getting called gay, and I was already getting beaten up.
Were there any teachers who you felt had your back at primary school?
Yeah, I think there's always been one or two teachers, really magical teachers, who've looked at me and seen, not just looked at me and been like, oh, yeah, he acts out, he speaks up, he's a class clown, who also go, no, no, we know what this is. So I had an amazing grade two teacher called Miss Borowski, who I'm wildly still in touch with now as an adult, who was a real tough but fair and one with a fantastic glint in her eye. And two teachers from my second primary school, Mrs. Blampede and Miss Reimer. And now what I've found out is that a bunch of the teachers from my primary school are all in a WhatsApp group together and come to my show, sort of like a Survivors of Reuben K support group, which is wild to me.
What about high school, Reuben? I mean, was that a place where you could find like-minded souls, you know?
No, high school was worse. High school was much worse because I think as a little kid in primary school, there's a little allowance for this. But in high school is so much about conformity. High school's where I wanted to change my name to Ben because Reuben, I thought, was too individualistic and too, I didn't want to stand out.
How did that play out?
Well, not well, because it's not the name, Reuben, it was me. And I would sort of, I'd open up my suit, my pencil case at recess and find that it had been like filled with everyone's spit. So they would have had to like, they would have had to go round with it and get everyone to spit in it. I would get pretty badly beaten up, my head slammed indoors. Some kids would grab my backpack and throw me into like open traffic and then jerk me back as cars came. Because I was also quite tiny. You know, I really didn't have a growth spurt until later. So now I'm 6'2", but I still have that vibe of, and I still sometimes think of myself as, oh, you're much smaller than you actually are.
Did teachers ever intervene or notice what was going on?
Rarely. Rarely. I think a lot of teachers just had no vocab on how to deal with a gay student. I remember when I was getting my head sort of examined after it was slammed in the door and I was bleeding, the vice principal saying, well, you need to tone your behaviour down. I think teachers just went, you just like the attention, whether it's good or bad. The only saving grace was that I could make the teachers laugh. So if a kid did come at me verbally, I knew I could destroy them verbally and I knew I could manipulate and make the making the teacher laugh is sort of the compounds the sin, right? Because the kids see that and they go, oh, there's some form of collusion maybe.
So performing was a kind of armour back then for you?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's a tale as old as time. Do you know what I mean? It is. It has to be. It's the only defence you have when you don't have a physical defence. My mum was brilliant in this because she said to me when she knew, because I walked into school knowing I didn't necessarily need it, in terms of I know I want to be a performer.
You knew even from a young age that was where you were headed.
Deep down in my bones. I think there was a month where I wanted to be a lawyer and Mum was
just
like, no, you're just argumentative, Reuben. You're just contrary. And then I was like, I want to be an astrophysicist because I read, I'm surely you're joking, Mr. Feynman. Right? I'll read a book and go, I could do that. I want to do that. And I've had that attitude of, I know I can do this. And I went into school kind of going, oh, I'm not going to need this. Right? It's the social thing that's the tough part. And I'm quite okay in a classroom. I could bullshit my way through most subjects, except obviously maths.
That
you cannot
bullshit
your way.
That whole astrophysics thing probably wouldn't have worked out then.
No, not at all. I think I've only ever passed one maths test in my life and it was 51% and the 1% was for effort. Thank you, Mr. Greenhalf.
What was your mum's advice then?
My mum's advice was, no one gives a shit where you went to school. School is the smallest part of your life. It is just something you have to survive until you get out into the real world and meet real people. And then your life begins. In essence, the only way out is through it. Just get through it.
So is that what happened once you graduated from high school? You were out in the world that was waiting for you?
In a way, yeah. I think I searched for many different worlds. I think I've really tried to find my people or some sort of sense of belonging in a lot of ways, because you just keep on getting told time and time again, no matter where you go, you don't belong. You don't belong. Even when I went to dance classes as a kid, it was like, oh, yeah, you're a bit too much. You don't quite belong. So I went to Swinburne TAFE when it was still TAFE, got asked to leave after 6 months.
What for, if you're at liberty to say?
Just not being very there. I would leave if I didn't like a class, or I would get good marks in the stuff I liked, and then the other stuff I'd fall behind or fall asleep in class. Just that thing of being something that people can't place. And then after that, I did a very Reuben thing, which was for 2 weeks I knuckled down and I became the best student. And then they said, we love you like this. Can you stay? And I went, nope, I'm leaving. What a piece of shit.
If you want me, I'm out the door.
Exactly.
You ended up at the Victorian College of Art studying musical theatre. What kind of fit was that?
I would still say not a good one. I would still say that. But I think there is because I knew I wanted to be a song and dance man, I was like, well, this will give the skills. This will show me what it is, right? And I went there and it was still a class. It was still about belonging in a social group, and that I just didn't have the skills. Maybe I was too traumatized from school. I don't know, but I really didn't enjoy the socials aspect of it.
So what kind of shows or performances were you doing back then? I guess your early 20s. Were you creating your own cabaret, own gigs by that point?
Yeah, I was. We had a little module in the course where we were encouraged to make a 10-minute cabaret, and everyone basically did their audition rep and added stories. And I did this thing, I think, about accidentally killing the neighbor's cat and all this stuff, because I'd always loved all of this crazy stand-up, all this wild, old-school stand-up, and wanted to make something different. And then I started making my own solo shows, which were A, not good, and B, not well-attended. But every so often I would get a nice review, which is nice, and then I would audition for musicals, and I would always get to the last two and then not make it.
So did you consider quitting? I mean, this sounds pretty tough.
So I was working in bars and nightclubs at this point, and I was partying pretty hard. I remember having to leave a shift or leave the bar one time to throw up in the bathrooms, come back and rinse my mouth out with creme de menthe and keep serving in this nightclub.
It's a really classy moment,
Well,
Reuben.
I'm a classy lady. I was in a bar doing an afternoon shift, coming down and hungover and saying, well, this is my life. I'm just going to do this. And this performer, Cameron McDonald, who is now an agent, he was one of the original Jersey Boys in Australia, walked past, stopped and said hi. And he said, how are you doing? I thought, well, I'm probably going to quit the beers and I'm just going to be a bartender. And then he just turned and went, who's going to make Angry Cabaret then? And I didn't think anyone from the industry regarded what I did with anything or had even seen it. And just the fact that he said that flipped a switch in my brain.
In what way? What changed?
I felt seen. I felt like what I was doing was valuable. It was a little tap on the shoulder to say, what you're doing, you're on the right path. Keep going. And then that night, my brother, who was working in London, said, Reuben, you have to come to London. You're not getting work in Australia. You'll get work in London. And we bought a ticket a year in advance, and I worked 7 days a week for a year to save up all the money. Went off to London.
And what was the cabaret scene or performance scene like there when you arrived?
Well, I went there with the feeling that it was still musical theatre that was the thing for me, weirdly. My first night in London was singing at an open mic bar. I just searched open mic cabaret something. And there's this bar called Cellar Door underneath the Lyceum, which is where The Lion King is playing. A sort of real temple to commercial musical theatre. And it's an old public toilet, rumoured to be the toilet that Oscar Wilde used to frequent. And it's now a cabaret bar.
And if it wasn't, then they should still say that, because what a great
line
could you find?
What a sales pitch. And on Wednesday nights, it was a guy at a piano and a cabaret host who was called Champagne Charlie. And every time someone ordered a champagne, we all had to shout, champagne. And anyone could get up with their sheet music. And sometimes you would get people going up and giving like an Edith Piaf that no one should ever see. And then sometimes you got West End people and sometimes you got a real mixed bag. And I got up there and I sang this song by Pip Fowler called Natural Born Killer, which is about a natural born killer of indoor plants. This was, and it's a charming, great song, nice big belty ending. And I sat back down, everyone applauded. And then this guy, this wiry, spectacled guy with a twinkle in his eye, sat down next to me and went, "Who are you? What are you? What are you doing?" And that man is Andrew Pepper, who's now still one of my best friends today. He guided me through London.
What other kinds of shows were you appearing in then at that point?
My first musical theatre role in London was in that runaway hit, Remains of the Day, the musical.
I wasn't aware that a musical had been made of Remains of the Day.
Most people aren't. Even the people in the audience aren't aware. I'm not sure I'm aware. But I was the Christopher Reeve role. When he stands up and says, "We cannot have gentlemen amateurs running politics. You have to have professionals." And he had like the 11 o'clock number. It's a big belty number. So it's great. Out of that, I got an all-male Iolanthe where I played the fairy Aunt Celia. And from that, I got McGaldy in a national tour of Evita. But that national tour of Evita was my first proper taste of musical theatre. And again, the social aspect, the improvisation, I couldn't do the same thing. The director sent me the most insulting notes, which didn't get read out by the company manager while we were on tour. He sent them to me privately.
Were you starting or working on your own material as well in London?
Very basically, yes. I did little gigs, never in makeup, never sort of playing with the femininity. It was sort of like in a tailcoat, that kind of thing. Because I'd seen the cabaret scene in London. And the cabaret scene in London wasn't sort of the musical theatre Sondheim on a stool vibe that was happening in Australia at the time. It was variety. It was European. It was circus. It was burlesque. And I had seen that really before. And then I saw the figure of the host, the MC, and I went, "Oh, you just look good, sing songs and talk shit. Oh, I can do this."
When did makeup enter the picture for you as a performer and how?
I was doing Panto in Oxford at the Oxford Playhouse and I was King Rat in Dick Whittington delivering lines like, "Oh, Dick, you've gone all limp." Three shows a day, 6 days a week. And I got a New Year's Eve gig, right? And I thought, "Oh, well, it's here, it's in Oxford, no one's going to know, shall I try some makeup?" And I put some makeup on and out of that it, I don't know, something just flipped, all the material just sort of flipped.
In what way does the makeup kind of makes it bigger or what's the makeup do differently for you as a performer?
I don't know because I don't see it. I don't look at it. But you know those satisfying videos of furniture dovetailing into one another in tongue and groove? It felt like that. It felt like everything just fit and the seams just went. It felt like I moved faster in the water.
Did you know how to apply it? Because you look amazing
no,
in makeup. How did you
terrible.
Learn?
Now I look. At the time, I thought I was divine. At the time, I looked in the mirror and thought, "Oh my God, I'm a mix between Lucifer and Caravaggio. I don't know what I am, but I'm fantastic." And now I look back in it and I go, "Oh, Ruben, you look like an extra in Wednesday." But it doesn't matter because it's about the feeling and what that does for the performer.
So as you were building your career in London, Ruben, what news did you get about your dad's health back here in Australia?
Well, I got the news that Dad had been sadly diagnosed with bowel cancer. And I've been living in London and not really speaking with Dad for quite a while. I think almost 6 years, 7 years. And there was something in my head that looked at my dad and went, "Oh, you're not going to make this." And that kind of made me go, "Oh, I don't think I have time," right? And it's that maybe ADHD thing of a deadline that makes you, kicks you into gear, makes you be an adult, gets you your executive function going. And also the flip that happened was that my dad suddenly became quite good at conflict. He just thought, "I've got no time for bullshit. I can't keep pleasing people or trying to be the nice person. So he chopped a whole bunch of people out of his life that weren't helping him. And I was like, oh, I love this part of you. Oh, I get this part
of
you.
So were you talking on the phone or how were you in contact?
I went back to Australia everyone just regroups for a second, right? And at the time it was like, oh, we can probably treat this. There's a risk we can't, but we can probably treat this. So everyone was quite high-spirited, but somewhere in the back of my head, I was just going, the pessimist in me was going, this isn't going to pan out well. And Dad and I sat down and had this conversation where we just said everything, every single thing to each other that we'd ever had to say. Where I said, I feel like you were frightened of me. I feel like you wish I was like my brother, who was easier to manage, very happy on his own. And anytime I had a fit and angry, because I have to process emotions physically. I can't think my way out of it because they're too big. And he would take that as a fight and he would immediately go, well, let's calm down, let's relax. And I don't know if you know this, but the worst way to diffuse a situation is to say, calm down to a raging teenager.
I've had some experience on both sides of that.
Right? It's the most infuriating thing, right? It only serves as an incendiary, but he couldn't grasp that. And then he said to me, I felt like you had contempt for me as a parent. And I said, I did because I thought you were weak and I thought you couldn't deal with things as they needed to be done. And we had this conversation and...
That sounds like a pretty painful conversation, but was it helpful?
It might have been painful for him to hear that I had contempt for him as a parent, but if it was... It felt like we were looking at something from above instead of being in it. So maybe in many ways I became less like conflict heavy and he became more less conflict averse, and we meet in the middle. And in this wonderful but, you know, ironically miserable turn of events, for the last 3 years of my dad's life, I got a dad back and he got a son back. You know, there was like a little piece of a puzzle, like a corner got put in, and that's a nice place to start, right?
His health continued to decline though, and you came back to Australia in 2016. How did that play out?
Well, we had a plan, and this was before death with dignity was legal, right? And the plan was that we were all going to come back. I had a show to put on for Comedy Festival, my first Comedy Festival show. If Dad was well enough, we'd all see the show. And then after the show was finished, in 2 weeks, Sam was going to come over and we were going to help Dad have a very comfortable death. And I landed I just wasn't prepared for the change that had gone through with my dad. He'd gone downhill very quickly, and what I saw there was, if anyone here has ever lost anyone to cancer, it's pretty wild. It's pretty devastating. And again, I think that's the first time I felt like I couldn't do something, you know. And the love and the admiration I have for my stepmom, Diana, who was caring for Dad at home and going through that, is insurmountable. And sadly, too, Dad apologized to me, of course. He was like, I'm sorry you had to come home to see this. I'm like, Dad, I'm here to see it. This is the reality of it. I'm not here to see it. I'm not here to do anything. I'm here to be it. He took a turn for the worst. He went into hospital, and for the 48 hours he was there, Diana and I just didn't leave. Just didn't leave. And Dad died in that hospital with my stepmom, my stepsister Kiara, and me all around him.
Did that mean, I mean, you'd come home, Ruben, to see your dad, but also to have this solo show, this one-person show at the Comedy Festival, did that mean that all had to be put on the back burner?
I don't understand what it is about performers, because in any other job, if you were an accountant, a dentist, a dog walker, you'd be like, I have to stop. I'm taking time off. Maybe because there's infrastructure around there to allow for it. You've got leave, you've got all these things, you have these things. But performers, and this is, you can see every single performer has this story of, oh, I've had to perform through a family member's death. I've had to perform on this. So what it meant was my opening night was the same day as his funeral, which I also, I don't know what the word is, hosted, feels too jovial for a funeral, right? And we were there at the Springvale Cemetery and all the mourners are gathering into the room. I'm in an appendix offside, just like crying, shaking. No, I can't do this. I can't do this. And then I got up onto the, I'll say stage, because it was a stage and there were people there, and something clicked in my head and I was like, oh, no, I've got this. And we got through it all. It was a beautiful memorial. And then my mum grabbed me at the reception and was like, okay, Ruben, you need to, if you're going to go and do this show now, you need to go home. And she put me in a car, drove me straight home, put me to bed, woke me up with a steak and mashed potato dinner and said, put that in your stomach and you get to the theatre.
What's that about? Like, why do you think your mum was so encouraging of you that night to go on stage and do, what, a comedy show, a cabaret show?
A comedy cabaret show. Yeah, my first one. I think because she understands emotional compartmentalization, and I think she understands what people need, even when they don't know what they need. And I think she could look at me and go, no, he needs to do this. And that show, my comedy is always skewed to the shocking, the dirty, or perhaps even the mean sometimes. And that show for me, I walked out there and it clicked something in the way I view work, in the way I view me and the world and comedy, which is I walked out there unable to be mean. And it meant that all the mean stuff got the hugest laugh. And I think I walked out there needing so much love that the audience had no option but to give it. And I realized, oh, you can only do the mean stuff, you can only do the cruel stuff, the risky stuff, if the audience sees the person underneath and knows that it's a joke. I think that gig was one of the best gigs of my life. And that isn't meant to be an egotistical statement or a thing. I think it could only have been that because of what had happened that day.
And has that insight stayed with you on stage since? 100%.
100%. I lose sight of it sometimes and have to remind myself of it continuously. But it stayed through with it.
And hopefully you don't need other family members to die in order to push you back into that insight.
Depends if they push me off.
Your mum has really, through her work as a documentary filmmaker and just through the sort of person that she is, really looked at the family history there in Germany. You and her went on a visit to Leipzig, to Germany. Tell me about that.
After the Holocaust, there is an organisation that runs throughout Europe and Germany that installs what are called Solperstein, which are stumbling stones. If anyone's been to Europe, they might see these tiny little brass squares in the ground with names and dates on them, and they commemorate the names of people who died in the war, specifically those who were taken to camps and murdered or kidnapped. And this organisation is an archival organisation that has to, of course, research all these names, and you have to go through a process of applying and giving all this information. And Mum, this amazing historian, was able to find the address of her grandparents, Elfriede's parents, and we all travelled over there to have these stones installed in front of their address and have this ceremony.
What happens at that ceremony?
So they do them in batches. So you go into a meeting hall in this Jewish community centre, and there's like 10 families there who are all there in Leipzig to have their stones. And we all speak a little bit about our families and you see their stories. And at the ceremony, while this man is excavating a hole and putting the stones in and mortaring around them, there's a klezmer band playing, and the people from the organisation give a brief history, and then the family are allowed to say some words. It was pretty emotional. I didn't know these people, but the connection to them, to my mum, watching my mum and my cousin Anne get up there and speak, and my brother. I know I've always been told that, you know, we don't belong. Jews get told we don't belong anywhere, and artists get told we don't belong anywhere. As a gay man, I've been told I don't belong anywhere. Even in as an artist, I was told I don't belong anywhere. And this little thing of Leipzig just is a piece of the puzzle. It answers the part of the question as to where I belong.
Did you manage to meet any of your extended family on that trip to Germany? Anyone from your mum's family?
There's none of them left. We are, as far as I know, in Australia, the last of the Altmans and Krums.
What about the grandfather, the father that your mother was taken away from as a little girl, Heinrich, who stayed there in his high-power job in East Germany?
He never had any more children. He adopted the children of his secretary, who he shacked up with. Her name was Lucy. And he was also having an affair with a woman in Germany who's a Stasi informant and was informing on him while sleeping with him.
And how did you find that out?
Because I met her in Germany. My mum, the historian, found all this information out, and I met her in Berlin. And the first thing she said to me on a street in Berlin was, "Your grandfather did not have a big penis." I used to visit him every Sunday for coffee, cake and sex, and most of the time I was there for the cake. The dialogue in my family cannot be written. When you said you were born to become a performer, I wasn't just born to become a performer. Every part of the DNA strand is sort of made for the proscenium arch and a spotlight.
And besides this anatomical fact of your grandfather, did you get any more sense of the kind of man that he was and why your grandmother would have made that decision? Or I mean, you know, I guess everything you'd heard about him was pretty horrible or pretty unlikable at the least. Did you get any other sense of him?
So in Berlin, I also met one of his stepchildren, Frank, who died this year, a few months ago, who was his partner and him were the guardians of a cemetery in Pankow. And Frank learned English through Rolling Stones records. And so when he spoke to you, he would only speak in rhyming couplets and Rolling Stones lyrics. And he was obsessed. Him and his partner were obsessed with visiting Tombstone, Texas. That was their big holiday. And they go in the full dress up, and I've got one of his belts. And they'd dress him in full cowboy and go to Tombstone, Texas and be like, "Look at us from East Germany. Here we are in America," you know. Their viewpoint of Heinrich, he is a bit more affectionate, I think, than my mum's and mine. But still, he was a hard man and a brutal man. And I remember I asked them once, "Can you tell me something good about this man? Anything that I feel is still part of me?" And they said, "Look, when he walked into a room, people listened. When he spoke, he was magnetic. He had that." And I'm like, okay, I can take that.
Tell me about the kind of way you approach performance now. You know, you started as a little kid singing and dancing, fashion parades in the front yard, and then tried to fit yourself into that form of musical theatre, which never felt right. Spent some time singing at a piano in the toilet where Oscar Wilde was arrested in London. How has it evolved to this point now? What's a Reuben Kay show like?
I've always really loved performers who, this is not going to sound good, who exhaust an audience. You know, you think about like Liza Minnelli at her most coked up, or Jim Carrey at his wildest, you know, where audiences go, "Oh my God, what have I just experienced," right? And I want that impression. I've really gone the extra mile to make sure people know I'm working hard sometimes, and, you know, sometimes to my benefit and sometimes to my detriment. I've always loved comedians who are angry, because I think the best comedy comes from anger, because it's about the urge to repair, the urge to change things. And because of how I grew up and my family, especially with watching all of these comedians, post-war comedians, I go, well, comedy is also a political tool. Comedy is a way to take power away from the forces that are trying to destroy the world, you know. It's a political tool, and it's a way to take the sheet off the boogeyman, to take power back.
And why cabaret, you know? Like, it's a form that's so strongly associated with that pre-war Germany in one of its forms. Is that part of its appeal to you? Is there some...
I don't think it could have been any other art form, because every other art form takes discipline. But cabaret takes discipline, but it takes an anarchic sense of doing away with form. It can be anything and everything. You know, people know cabaret by every other name under the sun. Just when you call it cabaret, they go, oh. You know, it's been music hall in the 1800s in London and Brighton and end of the pier stuff. It's been vaudeville. It's been cabaret. It's been in the songs and storytelling and jokes is like a timeless thing.
You talked about how all those different strains in your family story have kind of gone into creating the sort of performer that you are, Ruben. And I can't help but think that both your grandmas, you know, your big, ebullient Russian grandma, Rosa, and this sort of tragic grandma, Elfrieda, would love what their grandson's getting about the world doing. What do you think?
Oh, that's a really lovely thought. I think they'd both say, you need more frocks.
Ruben, it's been a really fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Ruben Kaye will be performing his show Engorged in Melbourne later this month and again early next year as part of the Sydney Festival. And Ruben is also the artistic director of the 2026 Adelaide Cabaret Festival. This episode of Conversations was created on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples and produced by Jen Leake. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.